The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Sharad Kutan, and with me on the Breakfast Grill is Alina Noor, Director of Foreign Policy and Security Studies at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies in Kuala Lumpur, and Dr. Subramaniam Pillai, an economist formerly at University of Science Malaysia and Nottingham University Malaysia. Thank you very much for joining me this morning. Tomorrow marks the first year that Donald Trump will be in the White House. So it's his first year anniversary. And numbers have come in terms of his approval rating among the American public. It's quite low. It's about 39%, seen lower than previous post-war presidents. But maybe our concerns are coming from a kind of a Malaysian point of view is what we're going to be talking about this morning. And I want to begin with you, Alina. You were there in Washington, D.C. in September, along with the delegation, Malaysian delegation, when our Prime Minister, Najib Razak, met with Donald Trump. From your perspective, what's happened to key institutions like the State Department that interfaces with the rest of the world and the kind of outlook coming out from Washington, D.C. in dealing with the rest of the world?
Yeah, there's been a lot of commentary about the mutedness of the State Department since President Trump came into office. And I think a lot of that, as you're alluding to, Sharad, has to do with the fact that there haven't been key positions filled for almost a year now. But that's slowly starting to change, is my understanding. The acting Assistant Secretary of State, Susan Thornton, is expected to be confirmed very soon. So there are key positions at the bureaucratic level, at the working level, that are expected to be filled, that have been in operation anyway, because these people have been in acting positions. And so I think what you're going to see moving forward is an execution of the policy that President Trump and his team have laid out, especially in the national security strategy. And that is expected to be slowly administered once these positions are filled. And that's my understanding, is it's beginning to happen.
Okay, we can come back to that later, especially what's happened to Rex Tillerson and the fate of those individuals associated with the State Department. I want to turn to you, Dr. Subra, before we kind of plunge into this, like, you know, the issue of trade. You're a trade expert, and so much of the rhetoric on the stump when Donald Trump was vying to become the next president of the United States was around economic issues. It was about jobs. It was about trade. He was against the TPP, for instance, and you know, he was concerned about the American the dollar and such. What do you see going into his office, as it were? Do you think he's actually delivered on some of his trade policy, if you can call policy, coming out of D.C.?
He has delivered some of it. As soon as he came into office, he withdrew from the TPP, which was a carefully crafted agreement, with the U.S. taking the lead and many other countries reluctantly joined. And it was an effort to encircle China. So as one Chinese strategist has pointed out, it was a gift to China. Trump gave a gift to China, and they are very happy about it. And now China is asserting its role as a free trader, while America is retreating into a protectionist mode, which is unbelievable given the history of U.S. and America, U.S. and China.
Okay, so the question of why Trump, and is Trump a symptom of what's happening within American society, the fear of job losses, maybe the squeeze on the American middle class? I mean, those are kind of factors that maybe created Trump in the first place. But there's an interesting theme in terms of vacuum, both on the economic and trade side, but also on the political side. We started with the talk of the State Department. Elena, you talked about Trump policy, and a lot of people say, well, there's Trump tweets, but is there policy? And do we see, and do you see, a policy coherence coming out of the White House under Donald Trump?
Yeah, it's hard to attribute any particular policy to President Trump. And to be fair, it's only his first year. You know, if we look back to the Obama administration, they didn't really come up with the idea of the rebalance or the pivot until 3 years into Obama's administration. The fact that there is a national security strategy already out before the first year anniversary of President Trump, I think says quite a bit about how his team is anxious to put a policy or an appearance of a policy out, particularly to this part of the world, the Asia Pacific. And I think if you compare the national security strategies and policy writ large of the U.S. to Asia, you'll see a lot of coherence and continuation. The language that is in official documents is also marked by a strand of coherence. So you hear, for example, this emphasis on partnerships and allies and alliances. Vietnam, Malaysia, the Philippines, these are all non-allies of the, not the Philippines, sorry, Vietnam, Malaysia, Indonesia. These are all identified as partners of the U.S. And this continues under President Trump. So there is a lot of continuation of policy, despite all the rhetoric and all the fast tweets flying around on President Trump's account. For us in Asia Pacific, it's pretty much more of the same.
Interesting, right? Subra, at this point in time, can we attribute a sense of policy coherence to the Trump administration in terms of trade issues?
Not at all, because on trade, there seems to be a lot of contradiction. On the one hand, you're pulled out of TPPA, you're threatening to walk out of NAFTA. Yet, Republicans and business interests, especially the big multinationals, it is to their disadvantage if Trump does that. For example, NAFTA, both America, Canada and Mexico are the two biggest trading partners, or two of the three biggest trading partners of the U.S. If they walk out of NAFTA, many of Trump's base support will suffer because they will lose jobs in the farm belt, which supported him extensively. And they are going to be opposed to that. So sometimes he doesn't seem to have a coherent policy on this. He personally, or his people are very close to him, the Commerce Secretary, and particularly the Commerce Secretary. But I think in the long run, there is a contradiction between his views and the mainstream Republican views and the business interest. And I'm not sure how this will work out.
Eleanor, have you been following the American response to Donald Trump in terms of how he positions himself against various world leaders? We know, of course, he's had that problem with his particular relationship with Vladimir Putin. So it seems far too friendly, far too warm, and he's often, you know, maybe caricatured as somebody who loves dictators. Mm-hmm. But he started off, you know, coming into the administration, into the White House, take a very strong position against China, for instance. But then he seemed to have fallen in love with Xi Jinping. I mean, what happened?
Yeah, so I think if you pay attention to his rhetoric domestically and compare that to what he says to world leaders, obviously the register is very different and his approach is very different. So to the domestic audience, he projects himself as a strong leader who's able to do business, to make fair deals for the American people, and to right what has been wrong under the Obama administration in particular. That's his beef. But then when he speaks to world leaders, he sort of, as you pointed out, walks back a little on that fiery rhetoric. And I think, you know, if you're charitable, that's one way of attributing his ability to distinguish how he projects himself to a domestic audience and then how he projects himself to an international audience. So he still has that strongman persona about him when he deals with Xi Jinping or Vladimir Putin. But he knows to step back a little and to tone down that fiery rhetoric that he reserves mainly for his base in the domestic scene.
Now, Dr. Subra, you know, this is very interesting because of the charges against China, policy, you know, currency manipulator. Do you think there is a kind of method in the madness of Donald Trump with regard to China?
I think recently there was an article in the New Yorker. It was called Make China Great Again. Actually,
meant ironically, right?
Exactly. It was written by a person called Ivan Osnos. And the main argument there is that whether inadvertently or not, actually, Trump's policies is making China great again.
But he's not a stupid man, right? So why is he doing this?
I'm not sure that he sometimes knows. I mean, he's not consistent. That's his problem. If you watch his tweets, they contradict themselves very often. Like with China, he started off with a very strong, I'm going to take a strong position against China. But as this article points out, the Chinese very quickly figured out his personality and they, what they call, they pandered to his ego a bit, gave him the red carpet and all that, and he apparently got bought into that. And he now thinks that Xi Jinping is a great leader, we have to be friends with China and all that. Actually, I would recommend your listeners to read this article from New Yorker.
Okay, we'll tweet that out.
It's a fantastic article because it shows how countries who have are smart can manipulate his personality to the advantage.
So the question is, right, and we come back to this over and over again, we often put so much on Donald Trump as if the American government is solely run by his fiat, right? And run by fiat, and that he's making those decisions. But is it such a simple machine? I would imagine that's much more complex. Alina? Yeah.
I would too, but it's very difficult to figure out what's going on in the White House, really, because Donald Trump has such a big personality and he really projects that. He has a very, very capable team of senior cabinet officials. And I think they're the ones who kind of have to keep him in check and also maybe explain his policies a little more from the 140 to 280 characters on his tweets. And so, for example, what you see is Rex Tillerson, recently it was reported that he takes Donald Trump's tweets, prints them out because he doesn't have a social media account himself, has his staff print out Donald Trump's tweets, and then tries to figure them out and work them into policy. So in a sense, Trump sets the headlines, and then his team has to figure out how to make that into policy.
Like reading tea leaves, are they? Yeah. I want to ask Dr. Subrat this. You know, we've had in the past American presidents, not maybe the sharpest tools in the box, like, say, the second George Bush, but he had a strong team, ideologically driven. We talk about the neocons that stood behind him. Is there a team, ideologically driven or pragmatic or whatever, that stands behind Trump in getting him to and pushing him in particular directions, you think?
I think there's one area where there is an ideological congruity between Trump and his cabinet and the Republicans, and that's the only area where Trump had a success, the passing of the tax bill. Because both Trump, as well as the Republican Party, as well as most of his cabinet members, if not all, wanted lower tax. And that's why where there was coherence in the entire team, the bill got passed. Everywhere else, there is a lack of coherence between Trump. Like if you look yesterday, this chief of staff said that Trump's policy on the wall is evolving. And then Trump contradicts him straight away. You know, this chief of staff is like your number two, you know.
I'm speaking to Alina Noor, Director, Foreign Policy and Security Studies Institute of Strategic and International Studies in Kuala Lumpur, and also Dr. Subramanian Pillay, an economist formerly at University of Science Malaysia and Nottingham University. We're considering Donald Trump's first year in the White House. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U-Mobile.
Good morning. If you just joined us, I'm Sharad Kutin. And with me, Alina Noor, Director, Foreign Policy and Security Studies at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, and also Dr. Subramanian Pillay, an economist, formerly with University of Science Malaysia and Nottingham University Malaysia. We're looking at Donald Trump's first year in office. And perhaps we could bring the discussion back to this region in terms of how we negotiated. But let's maybe sketch the situation. We had, during the Obama years, in the South China Sea, a lot of tension. Mm-hmm. There was a lot of tension. There was even talk of potential conflict, I mean, armed conflict happening in the South China Sea. A year into the Trump administration, Alina, where do things stand?
Well, since 2016, I think what you've seen is a more quiet mood in the South China Sea. And that's partly because it's a fait accompli, actually, what's taking place in the South China Sea. So there are military outposts, and China has basically built up to such an amount in the South China Sea that no other Southeast Asian claimant can really stand up to China in any meaningful way.
But what about the U.S.? Weren't they promising to, you know, under the expression, I think, keeping free trade movements within the sea as their way of asserting the security architecture that they had helmed for decades?
Yeah. So, I mean, that rhetoric is still out there, you know, this idea of preserving freedom of navigation for open seas and trade. And if you look, official documents all have that kind of phrasing. But I think what is different from the Obama years is that under the Trump administration, you have these freedom of navigation operations that are still being conducted on a fairly regular basis, but that are not actually announced, publicly announced or declared. So it reduces the public tension because once news of a freedom of navigation operation is conducted, usually there is a response that is expected from China, for example. And now it's just conducted as a matter of course. It's under the radar. And if there is a response, that's also kept under the radar. So in a sense, it helps with the situation because it pacifies tension somewhat.
Dr. Subra, we were also talking about the possibility of a trade war. And I remember in part of Trump's team were people, ideologues, hawks, who said, you know, we must fight China, kind of anticipating a trade war. We didn't have that, did we?
No, I don't think so. Because it is trade is a two-way thing. If you take action against China, China can take actions against you. And a lot of the things now are bound by WTO rules. So if you take unilateral action, the aggrieved parties can go to WTO and complain, and then there can be penalties on the country. So it's not so easy because China's economy and American economy are so intertwined that you there's an action and reaction to this, you know. So
yeah, in fact, I think people say, well, you know, to the American audience, they say to themselves, do we want iPhones that cost $9,000?
Oh, correct, you know, exactly. Like yesterday, Apple's announcement that they're going to create thousands of jobs. Almost all the, none of the, and very few of the jobs are going to manufacturing. If you can't assemble phones in America and sell them at that price and still make so much profit. I mean, Apple makes huge profits because they get to make the phones at about $500 or less, $200-$300 a piece, and sell them at $1,000. You can't do that if you are doing it in America.
Yeah. Now, Alina, I want to ask you about where Malaysia stands in all this. So we see, as an administration, a series of administration, Malaysian administrations, even including the Dr. Mahathir years, we've balanced our relationship between the U.S. and, you know, other powers, and the rising China is one in particular. But going forward, do you see a shift, a possible shift in where Malaysia kind of leans towards, especially as China becomes more prominent, both in geopolitical terms, but also in trade terms, and now as a major, major investor in our economy, controlling even some strategic assets as well?
Mm. The short answer is no, because I think the leaders in this country realize that as a small country, we have to take a pragmatic stance, and we will always have to balance between major powers. We cannot afford to align, not explicitly anyway, with any one particular power in general. There may be some issues that we fall in alignment with in particular, but as a general stance, I think our foreign policy position has always been to play it smart, at least try to, and try to balance between powers. I think the point about China being more of a factor in our domestic scene is certainly to be taken into account. But the counterpoint to that is, well, there is no other power, whether it's the US or Japan, that's able to match, you know, China's largesse and its offerings to not even Malaysia, just Malaysia, but also to the rest of this country. So where is the response from the other powers to match China, essentially?
Dr. Subra, you agree? I mean, do you think that eventually we'll end up, whether we say it explicitly or not, looking towards China for all kinds of things? You know, we're now buying military hardware from China as well.
No, I'm not surprised because if you go back to pre-colonial days, I mean, 500 years ago, Malaysia's largest trading partner was China and India and Indonesia. And I think that's what's going to happen in the next 40, 50 years. Because it's natural to trade with your neighbors first, because they are their nearest. Only colonialism distorted our trade relationships and all that. So it's not surprising that increasingly, China is already our number one trading partner, and it'll become more important as the years go by, and other countries will become less important. It's not that we won't trade. We still will be doing a lot of trade with the rest of the world. But China will become more and more important, and we have to take into account of that.
Alina, now, as you rightly pointed out, it's only been, Donald Trump's only been in office for a year. And I think a lot of people perhaps unfairly caricature the man as, slightly unstable, mm-hmm. Sort of doing a North Korea, and all those kinds of statements that have come out over the last year. What do you think of the real headwinds for the Trump administration, especially on the geopolitical and strategic side of the equation in the next 3 years of his administration?
I think as it relates to Asia, North Korea and the situation in the Korean Peninsula will continue to be a major priority. That's always been the case anyway in previous administrations as well. I think there will continue to be a focus on what sometimes President Trump calls radical Islamic terrorism. I'm still trying to grasp my head around what that actually means, but basically countering violent extremism. And I think this is an area that our interests with the U.S. will converge because it is a threat. Now, how we handle it with the United States, given all the rhetoric that's been flying around and all these perceptions that people have about Muslims, might be something we have to work out and iron out as we go along. But I think issues of security, issues of the military buildup, these will continue to figure into Trump's administration on the security and defense side, because that's how he projected himself as a champion of American strength. You know, he talks about strength through peace through strength in American foreign policy. And of course, it's meant to, at least that's how he sells it, to create jobs in the American market, building ships and building hardware, essentially.
Dr. Subra, this is a story, of course, it's for all countries around the world, growth, jobs, good jobs, well-paying jobs, and your place in the global division of labor. What do you think Donald Trump can possibly achieve for the American public, looking at what he's done over the last year in regard to that?
I think when you look at economic growth, it's not something that a president can do in 1 year. Actually, if in the last 1 year the American economy has been doing pretty well, and you can't attribute all of it to Trump.
Well, he takes the credit.
Of course he takes the credit, like all politicians do. When things go wrong, they blame somebody else. When things go right, they take credit, which is natural in most politicians do that. So these are actually policies that were done by the previous administration. And if you look at the job creation, Obama had created far more jobs than any other president before in the last in his 8 years, especially the last 4 years, because there's been a recovery. And it's just carrying on. So he has inherited an economy which is in an upswing, which is in a very good condition. So Trump is a beneficiary of that. So, of course, he's going to take credit for it. And he's lucky. In that sense.
The lucky president. Elena, we have a little more time left. I want to ask you, what do you see in terms of global responses to the Trump administration, either coming from Europe? We've been talking a bit about China, but you could just focus a little bit on Europe. I know the Europeans have been very concerned about the Trump administration's position on Iran and the nuclear deal in particular. Mm-hmm. Do you think there is essential suspicion or hostility towards the Trump administration? And going forward, what do you think is going to be the scenario?
I think we have to distinguish between, again, rhetoric and substance. There's been some concern about a distancing of U.S. interests from NATO, for example, and a divergence of interests and commonality from between the U.S. and its traditional European allies. On the surface, that may seem to be the case, but if you look at, again, the national security strategy, which I think is really our only guiding point right now, you'll see a lot of continuity. There's still a commitment to NATO. It's just that the U.S. demands that its European allies play more of a role, a more equal partnership that the U.S. expects of Europe. So I think going forward, there'll be some sticky issues and divergences on areas like immigration, for example. But on other areas, on mutual defense and NATO and how it confronts Russia, I think there will be convergence and there will remain continuity in how the U.S. conducts its policies towards Europe, but also mainly in the face of what is seen to be a Russian threat.
Thank you very much, both of you, for being here this morning. I've been speaking to Alina Noor, Director, Foreign Policy and Security Studies at the Institute of Strategic and International Studies, and Dr. Subramaniam Pillai, an economist formerly at University Science Malaysia and Nottingham University Malaysia. We wish Donald Trump all the best these next 3 years. I'm Sharad Kutin, and this has been The Breakfast Grill on BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
That episode of BFM Breakfast Grill was brought to you by U-Mobile, where data hearts you.